So thick, indeed, was the growth of his hair that it could scarcely be cut once every 8 days, and it weighed 200 shekels, that is, 5 minas. He remained in Jerusalem for 2 years, becoming the father of 3 sons and 1 daughter of surpassing beauty, whom Solomon's son Rehoboam later married, and by her had a child named Abijah. Absalom himself sent to Joab and begged him to fully appease his father and to ask that he be permitted to come before him, to see him and speak with him. When Joab neglected this, Absalom sent some of his own men and set fire to the field adjoining his. When Joab learned what had been done, he came to Absalom, reproaching him and asking his reason. Absalom said, "I devised this stratagem, since it could bring you to us when you were neglecting the instructions I gave you, so that you might reconcile me with my father. I beg you now, since you are here, to soften my father toward me, for I judge my return more grievous than my exile, so long as my father remains angry." Persuaded, and taking pity on his predicament, Joab acted as mediator with the king, and speaking on behalf of the young man, put him in so favorable a disposition that David at once summoned Absalom to himself. When Absalom threw himself to the ground and begged forgiveness for his offenses, David raised him up and declared an amnesty for what had happened. Now that things had turned out this way for him at his father's hands, Absalom, in a very short time, acquired many horses and many chariots, and had 50 armed men about him. Every day, early in the morning, he would present himself at the palace, and by speaking agreeably to those who came for judgment and were losing their cases, suggesting that it was for want of good counselors to his father that they had perhaps been wronged in their judgments, he won everyone's goodwill by saying that if he himself held that authority, he would administer much justice for them. By such means he courted the populace, and once he judged the people's goodwill toward him firmly secured, 4 years having now passed since his reconciliation with his father, he came to David at Hebron and asked leave to go and pay a vow he had made to God while he was in exile. When David granted the request, Absalom set out, and having sent word to many, a great crowd streamed together to him. Also present was David's counselor Ahithophel the Gilonite, along with 200 men sent from Jerusalem itself, who knew nothing of the plot but had simply been summoned as if for a sacrifice. And Absalom was proclaimed king by all, having engineered this outcome. When this news reached David, and word of his son's doings came to him against all expectation, he was seized with fear both at the impiety and at the audacity of it, marveling that Absalom, far from remembering the pardon granted him for his own offenses, had set his hand to a far worse and more lawless deed, seizing a kingship that, first, had not been given him by God, and second, was aimed at the overthrow of his own father. He resolved to flee across the Jordan. Calling together the most trusted of his friends, and taking counsel with them about his son's madness, and committing everything to the judgment of God, he left 10 concubines behind to guard the palace and departed from Jerusalem, accompanied by the rest of the populace who joined his flight along with the 600 armed men who had shared his first exile, back when Saul was alive. He persuaded Abiathar and Zadok, the high priests who had decided to go with him, along with all the Levites, to remain behind with the ark, on the ground that God would deliver him whether or not it was carried along with him. He instructed them to send him secret word of everything that happened, and he had as trusted agents for this purpose their sons, Ahimaaz son of Zadok and Jonathan son of Abiathar. Ittai the Gittite set out with him as well, overriding David's own wish, for David had tried to persuade him to stay behind, and for this reason he appeared all the more devoted to him. As David was going up the Mount of Olives barefoot, and everyone with him was weeping, word came that Ahithophel too was with Absalom and shared his views. This news added to his grief, and he called upon God, praying that he would turn Absalom's mind against Ahithophel, for he feared that, being a shrewd man and extremely sharp at perceiving what was advantageous, Ahithophel might persuade him with contrary advice. When he reached the summit of the mountain, he looked back at the city, and with many tears, prayed to God as one cast out of his kingdom. There a loyal friend named Hushai met him. Seeing that his clothes were torn and his head full of ashes, and that he was mourning the reversal of his fortunes, David comforted him and urged him to stop grieving, and finally begged him to go back to Absalom, pretending to side with him, so as to learn his most private plans and to work against Ahithophel's counsels. For Hushai, he said, would be of less help by staying with him than by going over to Absalom. Persuaded by David, Hushai left him and came to Jerusalem, and not long after, Absalom too arrived there. As David had gone on a little way, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. David had sent Ziba to look after the property he had given to the son of Jonathan, Saul's son, and Ziba now came with a pair of donkeys loaded with provisions, from which he told David to take whatever he and his companions needed. When David asked where he had left Mephibosheth, Ziba said that he had remained in Jerusalem, expecting to be made king because of the unrest, in memory of the benefits done for them, Saul. David was angered by this and gave to Ziba everything he had assigned to Mephibosheth, judging that Ziba deserved to hold it far more justly than the other man did. Ziba was overjoyed. But when David reached a place called Coronis, a kinsman of Saul named Shimei son of Gera came out against him, pelting him with stones and cursing him. When David's friends closed ranks and shielded him still more closely, Shimei went on reviling him, calling him a murderer and the author of many evils. He ordered him to leave the land as a thing accursed and polluted, and declared that he was thanking God for taking the kingship from him and exacting through David's own son the penalty for the wrongs he had done his former master. Everyone around David was inflamed with anger at this, above all Abishai, who wanted to kill Shimei on the spot, but David restrained him from his rage. "Let us not," he said, "add some new occasion to the troubles we already have. This raging dog's abuse means nothing to me and stirs no shame in me. I yield to God, since it is because of him that this man has been driven to such madness against us. It is no wonder that I suffer this at his hands, when I have already had experience of it from an impious son of my own. But we will yet receive some mercy from God, and if he wills it, we will overcome our enemies." So he continued on his way, paying no attention to Shimei, who ran along the other side of the mountain hurling abuse the whole time. On reaching the Jordan, David let his men, who were worn out, rest there. When Absalom and his counselor Ahithophel arrived at Jerusalem with the whole people, David's friend Hushai came to them, and bowing before Absalom, he prayed that his kingship would endure forever and for all time. When Absalom asked him why, having been counted among his father's closest friends and having seemed faithful in every way, he was not now with his father but had abandoned him to come over to him, Hushai answered shrewdly and prudently. "I must follow God," he said, "and the whole people. Since these have sided with you, my lord, I follow with them as well, for you have received the kingship from God. And I will show you the same loyalty and goodwill I am known to have given your father, now that I am trusted as your friend. There is no reason at all to be suspicious of my present position, for the kingship has not passed to another house. It has remained in the same family, only taken up now by the son." By speaking this way, he won Absalom over, for Absalom had been suspicious of him. Absalom then summoned Ahithophel and asked his counsel on what should be done. Ahithophel advised him to go in to his father's concubines, saying that from this act the people would come to believe that his breach with his father was irreconcilable, and would then join with great enthusiasm in the campaign against him. For up to now, he said, they were holding back from openly taking up hostility, expecting that father and son would be reconciled. Persuaded by this counsel, Absalom ordered a tent pitched for himself on the roof of the palace, in full view of the people, and went in and lay with his father's concubines. This happened in fulfillment of the prophecy of Nathan, who had foretold to David the attack that would come upon him from his own son. After Absalom had done what Ahithophel advised, he asked him a second time for counsel on the war against his father. Ahithophel asked for 12,000 chosen men, and promised that he would kill the father himself while bringing back those with him alive, and declared that once David was no longer living, the kingship would then be secure. Pleased with this plan, Absalom summoned also Hushai, David's chief friend, for that was the title Absalom gave him, and having told him Ahithophel's opinion, asked what he himself thought of it. Hushai realized that if Ahithophel's advice were carried out, David would be captured and put to death, and so he tried to put forward an opposing view. "You are surely not unaware, O king," he said, "of your father's courage and that of the men with him, that he has fought many wars and has always come off victorious over his enemies. As things now stand, it is likely that he will remain in camp, for he is a most capable general and skilled at foreseeing the tricks of an advancing enemy. Instead, toward evening he will leave his own men and either hide himself in one of the ravines or lie in ambush by some rock. When our forces engage, his men will fall back a little, and our own, growing bold at the thought that the king is near them, will stand their ground. And while they are fighting, the father will suddenly appear and put courage into his own men to face the danger while striking terror into yours. So weigh my advice as well against your own judgment, and once you have recognized which is best, refuse Ahithophel's plan, and instead send throughout the whole land of the Hebrews and summon them to the campaign against your father. Then take command of the army's full strength yourself and be its general, and do not entrust this to another. For you may expect to defeat him easily if you catch him out in the open with only a few men, while you yourself command many tens of thousands eager to display their zeal and devotion to you. And if your father shuts himself up under siege, we will bring that city down with siege engines and mines dug beneath it. By saying this, Hushai found more favor than Ahithophel, for Absalom preferred his plan to the others. It was God, in fact, who had arranged in Absalom's mind that Hushai's counsel should seem the better one. Hushai hurried at once to the high priests Zadok and Abiathar, told them both Ahithophel's plan and his own, and reported that it had been decided to act on his advice. He told them to send messengers to inform David and make known to him what had been planned, and to urge him to cross the Jordan quickly, lest his son change his mind and set out in pursuit, overtaking him before he was safe. The high priests, for this very purpose, kept their sons hidden outside the city so that they could carry word to David of what was happening. They sent a trusted servant girl to them with the plans made by Absalom, and instructed them to report this to David with all speed. They wasted no time in delay or hesitation, but taking their father's orders became at once devout and faithful messengers, and judging speed and swiftness of service to be best, they hurried to meet David. When they had gone about 2 stadia from the city, some horsemen caught sight of them and reported it to Absalom, who at once sent men to seize them. Realizing this, the priest's sons turned off the road and took refuge without delay in a village near Jerusalem called Bahurim, and begged a certain woman to hide them and keep them safe. She let the young men down into a well spread fleeces of wool over its mouth, and when their pursuers arrived and questioned her whether she had seen them, she did not deny having seen them, saying that after drinking at her house they had gone off again, and telling them that if they pursued vigorously they would catch them. When the pursuers, after chasing far and wide, failed to catch them, they turned back. Seeing them withdrawing, and that the young men were no longer in any danger of being seized, the woman drew them up and urged them to continue on the road before them. Making great haste and speed on their journey, they came to David and reported to him in full detail everything Absalom had planned. David at once ordered his men to cross the Jordan, since night had already fallen, and not to hesitate on that account. Ahithophel, seeing that his counsel had been passed over in favor of another's, mounted his beast and set out for Jilon, his native city. There he gathered all his household together and related to them everything he had advised Absalom, declaring that since his advice had not been followed, it was plain he himself would soon perish, but that David would prevail and be restored to the kingship. He said it was better, therefore, to take his own life freely and with dignity than to hand himself over for punishment to David, against whom he had joined in everything with Absalom. Having said this, he went into the innermost room of his house and hanged himself. His relatives took Ahithophel down from the noose and buried him, this being the judge he had made for himself over such a death. David, having crossed the Jordan as we said before, came to Mahanaim, a very fine and strongly fortified city. All the leading men of that region received him most gladly, both out of respect for his flight at that time and out of honor for his former prosperity. These were Barzillai the Gileadite, Shobai ruler of Ammon, and Machir, the foremost man of the land of Gilead. They provided every kindness for him and for his men's needs, so that neither beds properly made up nor bread and wine were lacking, but they even supplied an abundance of sacrificial animals, and, for men already worn out, a generous supply of things useful for rest and nourishment. While David's men were occupied with these things, Absalom, having gathered a great army of the Hebrews against his father, crossed the Jordan River and camped not far from Mahanaim, in the land of the Gileadites, appointing Amasa as general of the whole force in place of his kinsman Joab, whose position he took over. For Amasa's father was Jether, and his mother Abigail, who together with Zeruiah, Joab's mother, were David's sisters. When David, having numbered the men with him, found them to be about 4,000, he decided not to wait for Absalom to come against him, but adding to his forces commanders of thousands and of hundreds, he divided them into three parts. One part he entrusted to the general Joab, another to Joab's brother Abishai, and the third division he gave into the charge of Ittai, who was both a familiar friend and a man from the city of Gath. His friends, with a very wise judgment, would not allow David himself to go out with them into battle, saying that if they were defeated together with him, they would lose all hope of recovery. But if defeated in one part of the army, they could flee to him with the rest, and he would provide them a stronger force. And it was likely, they said, that the enemy too would suspect there was another army with him. Persuaded by this advice, David decided to remain himself at Mahanaim, and as he sent out his friends and commanders to the war, he urged them to show eagerness, loyalty, and remembrance of it if they had received any fair treatment from him. And he begged them, when they had overcome him, to spare his son Absalom, so that he might not do himself some harm once Absalom was dead. Having prayed for their victory, he sent the army out. Joab drew up his force facing the enemy in a great plain with a forest lying behind it, and Absalom led out his army to meet him. When the battle was joined, both sides displayed great feats of strength and daring. David's men risking everything and using all their zeal to recover the kingship for him, Absalom's men sparing no effort in either doing or suffering anything so that he should not be deprived of it and pay the penalty to his father for what he had dared. And further, the greater number on Absalom's side fighting so as not to be defeated by Joab's men, who were the fewer, since this would have been the greatest disgrace to them, while David's soldiers strove to overcome so vast a multitude. A fierce struggle broke out, and David's men won, superior both in strength and in skill at warfare. Pursuing the fleeing enemy through woods and ravines, they captured some and killed many, so that more fell in flight than in battle. About 20,000 fell that day. All of David's men then rushed upon Absalom, for he was conspicuous to them both for his beauty and his stature. Fearing that his enemies would overtake him, he mounted the royal mule and fled. But as he was carried along swiftly, and light because of the mule's motion and speed, his hair became entangled in a rough tree with great branches spreading far out, and he was left hanging there in an extraordinary way. The mule, being swift, went on ahead still carrying what it took to be its rider's weight, while Absalom hung suspended from the branches, at the mercy of his enemies. One of David's soldiers, seeing this, reported it to Joab, and when the general said he would have given him 50 shekels if he had shot and killed Absalom, the soldier replied, "Even if you were going to give me 1,000, I would not have done that to my master's son, especially when he himself, in the hearing of all of us, begged that the young man be spared." Joab then ordered him to show where he had seen Absalom hanging, and shooting him through the heart with an arrow, killed him, and the men bearing Joab's weapons surrounded the tree and pulled the corpse down. They threw the body into a deep, gaping pit and heaped stones upon it, until it took on both the shape and the size of a tomb. Joab then sounded the recall and kept his own soldiers from pursuing the enemy's forces further, sparing his fellow countrymen. Absalom had set up for himself, in the king's valley 2 stadia from Jerusalem, a pillar of marble which he called his own hand, saying that since his children had died, his name would still remain on the pillar, for he had 3 sons and 1 daughter named Tamar, as we said before. She married Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and their child, who succeeded to the kingship, was Abijah. We will speak of these matters more fittingly later in our history. After Absalom's death, the people scattered to their homes. Ahimaaz, son of the high priest Zadok, came to Joab and asked him to let him go to David and report the victory, and bring him the good news that he had received help and providence from God. Joab told him it was not fitting for him, who had always been a bearer of good news, now to go and announce to the king the death of his son, and asked him to remain, Instead, he called Hushai and assigned him this task, so that he might report to the king what he himself had seen. When Ahimaaz again begged him to let him carry the message too, saying that he would speak only of the victory and stay silent about Absalom's death, Joab allowed him to go to David. And taking the shorter route, Cushi outran Ahimaaz on the shorter road, since he alone knew it. David was sitting between the gates, waiting for someone to come from the battle and report how it had gone, when a watchman saw Ahimaaz running but could not yet tell who he was, and told David that he saw a man approaching. When the watchman said this was good news, he soon reported that another man was following the first. The watchman, hearing that this second man too was a messenger, and now recognizing Ahimaaz drawing near, announced that it was the son of Zadok the high priest running toward them. David, overjoyed, said that this must be a messenger of good news, bringing him something he had prayed for from the battle. While the king was still speaking, Ahimaaz appeared. Ahimaaz bowed before the king, and when asked about the battle, he announced victory and triumph. Asked whether he had anything to report about the boy, he said that he himself had set out toward the king as soon as the enemy broke, but had heard a great shout of men pursuing Absalom and had been able to learn nothing more, because he had been sent by Joab and was hurrying to bring news of the victory. When Cushi arrived, bowed, and reported the victory, David questioned him about the boy. He replied, "May whatever has happened to Absalom happen to your enemies." This word did not let David, or his soldiers, keep the great joy of the victory. He went up to the highest part of the city and wept for his son, beating his chest, tearing at his hair, and abusing himself in every way, crying out, "My child, would that death had come to me and that I had died together with you." For he was by nature deeply affectionate and felt still more tenderly toward that son. When the army and Joab heard that the king was mourning his son so bitterly, they were ashamed to enter the city in the manner of victors, and all of them, downcast and in tears, passed through it as if returning from a defeat. While the king sat covered and groaning for his son, Joab came into him and, trying to console him, said, "Master, you do not realize that you are wronging yourself by what you are doing. You seem to hate the very men who love you and have risked their lives for you, and yourself and your own family besides, while you cherish and long for men who no longer exist, men who died justly. For if Absalom had prevailed and held the kingdom securely, not one of us would have survived. All of us, beginning with you and your own children, would have perished miserably, and our enemies would not have wept over us but would have rejoiced, and punished anyone who pitied us in our misfortune. Are you not ashamed to act this way toward an enemy, simply because he happened, impiously, to be your son? Put an end to this unjust grief, come out and show yourself to your own soldiers, and thank them for the victory and for the eagerness they showed in the fighting. For I swear that if you continue as you are behaving now, I will persuade the people to desert you this very day and hand the kingdom to another, and then I will make your grief bitter and real." By these words, Joab turned David away from his grief and brought the king back to consider what needed to be done. David changed his appearance and made himself presentable to be seen by the people, and took his seat by the gates, so that the whole population, on hearing of it, ran together to him and greeted him warmly. That is how these events unfolded. Those of the Hebrews who had fought with Absalom and had retreated from the battle each went back to their own homes and began sending word to one another throughout the cities, reminding themselves of the benefits David had done them and of the freedom he had won for them by delivering them from many great wars, and complaining that, after driving him from the kingdom and handing it to another, now that the man they had set up as their leader was dead. They were not urging David to set aside his anger and be favorably disposed toward them, and to take up, as he had before, the care of the state by resuming the kingship. These reports were repeatedly brought to David, and he in turn sent word to Zadok and Abiathar, the high priests, telling them to speak with the leaders of the tribe of Judah about how shameful it was that other tribes should be first to make David king, ahead of Judah's own tribe, especially since they were his kinsmen and shared a common blood with him. He gave the same instructions to be conveyed to Amasa the general, telling him that as David's own sister's son, he ought to persuade the people to restore the kingdom to David, and that he could expect from David not only reconciliation, for that had already been granted, but also command of the whole army, the very post that Absalom too had given him. The high priests spoke to the leaders of the tribe as instructed, and also persuaded Amasa, telling him what the king had said, to take up the king's cause in earnest. He at once persuaded the tribe to send envoys to David urging him to return to his own kingdom, and all the Israelites did the same at Amasa's urging. When the envoys reached him, David set out for Jerusalem. The tribe of Judah outran all the others in meeting the king at the Jordan River, along with Shimei son of Gera, who brought 1,000 men from the tribe of Benjamin, and Ziba, the freedman of Saul, with his 15 sons and 20 servants. Together with the tribe of Judah, these men bridged the river so that the king might cross most easily with his own people. When he reached the Jordan, the tribe of Judah welcomed him, and Shimei, falling before him as he stepped onto the bridge and clasping his feet, begged him to forgive the wrongs done against him, and not to hold it bitterly against him, nor to think it right, now that he had the power to punish, to make that his first act, but rather to consider that Shimei, having repented of his offenses, had hurried to come to him first of all. While he was pleading and lamenting in this way, Abishai, Joab's brother, said, "Shall he not die for this, then, for cursing the one appointed king by God?" David turned to him and said, "Will you never stop, sons of Zeruiah? Do not stir up new troubles and factions for us on top of the old ones. You ought to know that today I begin my reign. I therefore swear to grant amnesty from punishment to all who did wrong, and to hold nothing against any offender." And he said, "As for you, Shimei, take courage and have no fear of death." Shimei bowed before him and went ahead. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also came to meet him, wearing filthy clothing and with his hair long and unkempt. For since David's flight, he had neither cut his hair in his grief nor cleaned his clothing, judging this misfortune fitting given the change in the king's fortunes. He had also been unjustly slandered to David by his steward Ziba. After greeting David and bowing before him, David began to ask why he had not gone out with him and shared in his flight. He said that this was Ziba's wrongdoing. Ordered to prepare what was needed for the journey, Ziba had paid no attention, but had disobeyed him as if he were some slave. "Yet if my legs had been sound, I would not have failed to use them to accompany you in your flight. Nor is this the only wrong he has done to my loyalty toward you, my lord. He has also slandered and lied about me out of malice. But I know that your judgment, being just and eager to uphold the truth and devoted to God, will accept none of this. For though you were in danger of suffering far worse at the hands of my grandfather, and though our whole family deserved to perish for those wrongs, you were moderate and kind to me then, forgetting all of that above everyone else, at the very time when your memory of it gave you full power to punish us for it. You judged me your friend and kept me at your table every day, and I lacked nothing that your closest kinsmen enjoyed." When he had said this, David decided neither to punish Mephibosheth nor to condemn Ziba as a liar against him. But saying that he forgave Mephibosheth for not having come with Ziba, he promised to grant Ziba's request and ordered that half of the estate be restored to Mephibosheth. But Mephibosheth said, "Let Ziba have it all. It is enough for me that you have recovered your kingdom." David urged Barzillai the Gileadite, a large and handsome man who had provided much for him in the camps and had escorted him as far as the Jordan, to come along with him to Jerusalem, promising to care for him in his old age with every honor and to look after him as a father. But Barzillai, out of longing for his home, declined to spend his remaining time with him, saying that his old age was such that, having reached 80 years, he could no longer enjoy pleasures, but instead needed to think about his final rest and burial. He asked, since David wished to grant him his desire, to be released for that purpose. He said he could no longer make sense of food or drink because of his age, and that his hearing, too, was already closed to the sound of flutes and other instruments, the very things that delight those who live alongside kings. Since he pleaded so earnestly, David said, "I release you, but leave your son Achimas with me. I will share with him all good things." So Barzillai, leaving his son behind, bowed before the king, prayed that everything he wished for his own soul might come to pass, and returned home. David arrived at Gilgal, already having about half the whole people around him, together with the tribe of Judah. The leaders of every tribe came to him at Gilgal with a large crowd, and they reproached the tribe of Judah for having come to him secretly, saying that all of them together, with one mind, ought to have gone to meet him. The leaders of the tribe of Judah asked them not to be aggrieved at having been anticipated since, being his kinsmen and therefore all the more concerned for him and devoted to him, they had hurried to be first not in order to receive gifts by arriving early, so that the others, arriving later, might have grounds for resentment on that score. When the leaders of the tribe of Judah had said this, the leaders of the other tribes did not stay quiet, but said, "We are astonished, brothers, that you call the king kinsman of yourselves alone. He who received authority over all of us from God is judged to be kinsman of us all. For this reason, the people hold 11 shares, and you hold one, and yet we are the elder, and you have not acted justly in coming to the king in secret." While the leaders were exchanging such words with one another, a wicked man who delighted in strife, named Sheba, son of Bichri, of the tribe of Benjamin, stood up in the midst of the crowd, shouted loudly, and said, "None of us has any share from David, nor any portion with the son of Jesse." And after these words, he sounded a trumpet as a signal of war against the king, and everyone followed him, abandoning David. Only the tribe of Judah remained with him and established him in the royal residence at Jerusalem. As for the concubines with whom his son Absalom had lain, he moved them to another house, ordering their attendants to provide them with everything they needed, but he no longer went in to them himself. He also appointed Amasa general, giving him the command that Joab had held, and ordered him to gather as large a force as he could from the tribe of Judah and come to him within 3 days, so that, once he had handed over the whole army to him, he could send him out to make war on the son of Bichri. When Amasa had gone out and was slow in gathering the army, and when he had not returned by the 3rd day, the king said to Joab that it was not to their advantage to give Sheba a respite, lest, given more time to prepare, he become the cause of still greater troubles and disasters than Absalom had been for them. So do not wait for anyone. Take the force you have, along with the 600 men under your brother Abishai, and pursue the enemy, and wherever you catch up with him, try to engage him. Hurry to get ahead of him, so that he does not seize fortified cities and create for us struggles and much hard toil." Joab decided to delay no longer, but took his brother and the 600 men, and, ordering whatever other force remained in Jerusalem to follow, set out against Sheba. By the time he reached Jibon, a village 40 stadia from Jerusalem, Amasa, who had gathered a large force, met him there. Joab had a sword girded on and was wearing a breastplate. As Amasa approached to greet him, Joab contrived for the sword to fall of its own accord from its sheath, picked it up from the ground, and with his other hand took hold of Amasa's beard as if to kiss him. As Amasa drew near without suspecting anything, and struck him in the belly and killed him an impious and wholly unholy act, since he had grown jealous of the command and of the equal honor Amasa held with the king, though Amasa was a good young man, his kinsman, and had done him no wrong. It was for this same reason that he had also murdered Abner. But that earlier crime of his had seemed to have a plausible excuse that made it forgivable, since it was thought to be vengeance for his brother Asahel. The murder of Amasa had no such cover. Having killed his fellow general, he pursued Sheba, leaving one man beside the body with orders to shout to the army that Amasa had died justly and for good cause. "But if you are loyal to the king, follow his general Joab and his brother Abishai." While the body lay in the road and the whole crowd streamed together around it, and as a crowd is wont to do, marveled and pitied him as they stood by, the guard lifted it from there and carried it to a place well off the road, laid it down, and covered it with a garment. Once this was done, all the people followed Joab. As he pursued Sheba through the whole territory of the Israelites, someone told him that Sheba was in a fortified city. Sheba, they learned, was in a town called Abel Bethmaachah. Joab marched there, invested the city with his army, threw up a rampart around it, and ordered his soldiers to undermine the walls and tear them down. For since the people inside had refused to admit him, he was thoroughly incensed against them. But a certain woman, prudent and intelligent, who saw her city already brought to the last extremity, climbed onto the wall and, through the men at arms, asked to see Joab. When he came forward, she began to speak. "God," she said, "appointed kings and generals so that they might destroy the enemies of the Hebrews and secure them peace from them. Yet here he was, bent on tearing down and sacking a mother city of Israel that had done no wrong." Joab answered that he prayed God would remain gracious to her, but that this was his own position. He had no wish to kill any of the people, still less to destroy so great a city. If, however, they would hand over Sheba son of Bichri, who had risen against the king, to face punishment, he would break off the siege and lead his army away. When the woman heard Joab's terms, she asked him to wait a little, for the enemy's head would be thrown to him at once, and went down to her fellow citizens. "Would you rather," she said, "perish miserably, you and your children and your wives, for the sake of a worthless man whose very identity nobody even knows, and set him up against David, who has done you so much good, as your king, pitting one town against a power so vast?" She persuaded them, and they cut off Sheba's head and threw it into Joab's camp. When this was done, the king's general sounded the recall, broke off the siege, and, returning to Jerusalem, was once more appointed commander of the whole people. The king also set Benaiah over his bodyguard and the 600, made Adoram overseer of the tribute, Jehoshaphat son of Ahilud keeper of the records, Sheva scribe, and appointed Zadok and Abiathar priests. After this, when the land was being wasted by famine, David begged God to have mercy on the people, and to make known to him both the cause of it and the cure for the affliction. The prophets declared that God wished the Gibeonites to obtain redress, whom King Saul, in killing them, had wronged, breaking faith with the oaths that Joshua the general and the council of elders had sworn to them. If then, David gave the Gibeonites whatever satisfaction they themselves wished for the men who had been killed, God promised to be reconciled and to free the people from their sufferings. On learning this from the prophets, David sent for the Gibeonites and asked them what they wished to receive. When they asked to be given 7 sons from Saul's line for punishment, the king searched them out and handed them over, sparing only Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan. The Gibeonites took the men and punished them as they wished. At once God began to send rain, calling the earth back to the bearing of fruit and releasing it from the drought that had gripped it before, and the land of the Hebrews flourished again. Not long after, the king campaigned against the Philistines, and when he joined battle with them and routed them, he became separated from his men in the pursuit, and growing exhausted, was seen by one of the enemy, Achmon by name, son of Arapha, one of the descendants of the giants, who, armed with a spear whose shaft alone weighed 300 shekels, and a coat of chain mail, and a sword, wheeled about and rushed at him, meaning to kill the king of his enemies, for David had collapsed from fatigue. But Abishai, Joab's brother, appeared suddenly, threw himself over the fallen king to shield him, and killed the enemy. The army took it hard that the king had come so close to danger, and the officers made him swear never again to go into battle at their side, lest through his own courage and eagerness he suffer some disaster and rob the people of the good things he had already given them, and of all they would still share in through the long years he had yet to live. When the Philistines mustered at the city of Jezer, the king heard of it and sent an army against them. On that occasion, Sibekai the Hittite, one of David's bravest men, distinguished himself greatly. He killed many who boasted descent from the giants and prided themselves greatly on their courage, and became the cause of victory for the Hebrews. After that defeat, the Philistines went to war again, and when David sent an army against them, his kinsman Elhanan distinguished himself. He fought a single combat with the bravest of all the Philistines, killed him, and put the rest to flight, and many of them died fighting. After a brief pause, they encamped by a city near the borders of the land of the Hebrews. Among them was a man 6 cubits in height, who had on each hand and each foot 1 finger or toe more than is natural. Out of the army David sent against them, Jonathan, son of Shimea, fought him in single combat, killed him, and having turned the whole battle in the balance, carried off the glory of the exploit, for this Philistine too boasted of being a descendant of the giants. After this battle, they made war on the Israelites no more. Now that he was rid of wars and dangers and enjoyed deep peace for the rest of his days, David composed odes and hymns to God in varied meters, some in trimeters, some in pentameters, and, having had instruments made, he taught the Levites to sing hymns to God with them, both on the day called the Sabbath and on the other festivals. The instruments were of the following kind. The kinnira, strung with 10 strings, was struck with a plectrum. The nabla, having 12 notes, was played with the fingers, and there were cymbals, broad, large, and made of bronze. On these matters let so much be said, that we may not be wholly ignorant of the nature of the instruments already mentioned. All the men about the king were brave, but of these, the most distinguished and brilliant in their deeds numbered 38, of whom I shall recount the exploits of 5 only. For these will suffice to make plain the courage of the rest as well, since they too were capable of subduing territory and mastering great nations. First, then, was Jashobam son of Hachmoni, who often leapt into the enemy's battle line and would not stop fighting until he had struck down 900 of them. After him came Eleazar son of Dodo, who was with the king at Pasdammim. Once, when the Israelites, terrified at the numbers of the Philistines, were fleeing, he alone stood his ground, closed with the enemy, and killed so many of them that his sword stuck fast to his hand with the blood. And the Israelites, seeing the Philistines routed by him, came down and joined the pursuit, winning a victory that was marveled at and talked of ever after, Eleazar doing the killing, while the crowd followed and stripped the slain. Third was Shammah, son of Agi. When the Philistines had drawn up their line at a place called Lehi, and the Hebrews, once more afraid of their numbers, would not stand, he alone held his ground like an army and a battle line by himself, cutting some of them down and pursuing the rest, who could not withstand his strength and force, and turned to flee. Such were the deeds of hand and battle these three performed. At the time when, the king being in Jerusalem, the Philistine army came up to make war, David went up to the citadel, as we have said before, to inquire of God about the war. And while the enemy's camp lay in the valley that stretches as far as the city of Bethlehem, 20 stadia from Jerusalem, David said to his companions, "What good water we have in my homeland!" Marveling most of all at the water in the cistern by the gate, and saying that anyone who brought him a drink from it would earn more gratitude from him than if he gave him great sums of money. On hearing this, the three men at once dashed out, charged straight through the middle of the enemy's camp, reached Bethlehem, drew the water, and made their way back through the camp to the king, so that the Philistines, struck with astonishment at their daring and courage, held still and did not venture against them, despising their small number. But when the water was brought, the king would not drink it, saying that it had been fetched at the risk and cost of men's blood, and that for this reason it was not right for him to drink it. Instead, he poured it out as a libation to God and gave thanks to him for the men's safe return. After these three came Abishai, Joab's brother, who in a single day killed 600 of the enemy. Fifth was Naharai, a priest by birth, who, when challenged by distinguished brothers in the land of Moab, overcame them by his valor. Again, when an Egyptian of remarkable size challenged him, though unarmed he killed him, throwing the man's own spear at him, for he had wrested the javelin from him, and while the man was still alive and fighting, stripped him and finished him off with his own weapons. One might add this exploit also to those already told, either as the foremost of them for sheer courage or at least as their equal. Once, while God sent snow, a lion slipped into a pit and fell in, and since the mouth of the pit was narrow, it was clear it would be shut off entirely once the snow choked it, so that, seeing no way out to safety, the lion roared. Naharai, who happened to be traveling at the time, heard the beast, came toward the sound, went down into the pit, struck it as it fought him with the club he had in hand, and killed it on the spot. The rest of the men, too, were of like courage in their exploits. Now King David, wishing to know how many tens of thousands the people numbered, forgot the command of Moses, who had declared that if the multitude were counted, a half shekel should be paid to God for each head, and ordered Joab the general to go and number the whole people. Joab said this was not necessary and did not think it should be done. But David would not be persuaded, and ordered him to set out without delay on the census of the Hebrews. Joab took the leaders of the tribes and scribes, and going through the land of the Israelites and noting how great the multitude was, returned to Jerusalem to the king after 9 months and 20 days, and delivered to the king the number of the people, apart from the tribe of Benjamin, for he had not managed to count it, nor the tribe of Levi either, since the king repented of the sin he had committed against God. The number of the other Israelites able to bear arms and go to war was 900,000, and the tribe of Judah by itself numbered 400,000. When the prophets made known to David that God was angry with him, he began to entreat and implore that God be gracious and forgive him his sin. God sent Gad the prophet to him bearing 3 choices, that he might select whichever of them he judged best. Whether he wished a famine to come upon the land for 7 years, or to be defeated by his enemies after fighting them for 3 months, or a pestilence and plague to fall on the Hebrews for 3 days. Caught in a helpless choice among great evils, David was grieved and thrown into deep confusion. When the prophet said that one of these must happen of necessity and pressed him to answer quickly, so that he might report his choice to God, the king reasoned that if he asked for famine, he would seem to have chosen it for himself without fear, since he had great stores of grain laid up, but to the harm of others. And if the people should be beaten for 3 months, since he had the bravest men about him and fortresses too, and so had nothing to fear, it would look as if he had chosen war for that reason. So he asked for a suffering common to kings and subjects alike, in which the fear falls equally on everyone, declaring that it was far better to fall into the hands of God than into the hands of enemies. Hearing this, the prophet reported it to God, who sent the pestilence and destruction upon the Hebrews. They died not in one manner, nor in a way easy to trace to a single disease. The affliction was one, yet it swept them away by countless causes and pretexts that they could not even imagine. One man perished after another, and the calamity, coming on unseen, brought a swift end, some giving up their lives suddenly amid violent pains and bitter agony, others wasting away with their sufferings and not even being left for burial, but utterly consumed in the very act of sickening. Still others, as darkness suddenly ran over their eyes, choked and cried out in anguish. And some, while burying one of their own household, died themselves in the midst of it, leaving the burial unfinished. Beginning at dawn, the plague destroyed them until the hour of breakfast, and 70,000 perished. The angel stretched out his hand, sending the calamity to Jerusalem as well. But the king, clothed in sackcloth, lay upon the ground imploring God and begging him now at last to relent and, satisfied with those already lost, to stop. Looking up into the air, the king saw the angel being borne through it toward Jerusalem, sword drawn, and said to God that he himself, the shepherd, deserved to be punished, while the flock, having done no wrong, ought to be spared. He begged that the wrath fall upon him and all his line, and that the people be spared. God, hearing his supplication, stopped the plague, and sending Gad the prophet, ordered him to go up at once to the thrashing floor of Araunah the Jebusite, and building an altar there to God, to offer sacrifice. David, on hearing this, did not delay but hastened at once to the place appointed to him. Araunah, who was thrashing his grain, when he saw the king approaching with all his attendants, ran up to him and bowed down. He was Jebusite by birth, but a close friend Araunah asked what David wanted with his servant, and the king told him he wished to buy the thrashing floor so that he could build an altar on it to God and offer a sacrifice. Araunah said he would give him the thrashing floor itself, along with the plows and the oxen for the burnt offering, and that he prayed God would gladly accept the sacrifice. The king replied that he loved him for his simplicity and generosity and would accept the gift, but insisted on paying him the full value of everything, since it was not right to offer a sacrifice that cost him nothing. When Araunah said he might do as he wished, David bought the thrashing floor from him for 50 shekels. He built the altar there, performed the sacred rites, offered the burnt offering, and brought peace offerings as well. By these, the divine anger was appeased, and God became favorable again. It was to that same place that Abraham had once brought his son Isaac to offer him as a burnt sacrifice. And just as the boy was about to be slaughtered, a ram suddenly appeared standing by the altar, which Abraham sacrificed in his son's place, as we have related earlier. When King David saw that God had heard his prayer and had gladly accepted the sacrifice, he decided to call that entire place the altar of the whole people and to build a temple to God there. And in saying this, he unwittingly spoke a word that pointed to the future. For God, sending the prophet to him, said that it was there that his son would build him a temple, the son who was to succeed him on the throne. After this prophecy, the king ordered the resident aliens to be counted, and 81,000 were found. Of these, he appointed 80,000 as stonecutters, and set the rest to carrying the stones, placing 3,500 men in charge of the workers. He also prepared a great quantity of iron and bronze for the work, and enormous stores of cedar timber, which the Tyrians and Sidonians sent him, since he had written to them asking for a supply of wood. He told his friends that he was making these preparations now so that the son who was to reign after him would find the materials for the building ready at hand, and would not, being young and inexperienced in such matters, have to gather them himself because of his youth, but could carry out the work with everything already in place. He summoned his son Solomon, and when he was about to succeed to the kingdom, charged him to build a temple to God, telling him that God had prevented him from doing so himself, because he wanted to, since his hands were stained with blood and war, but had foretold that Solomon, his youngest son, who would bear that very name, would build it for him. God had promised to watch over him as a father would, and to make the land of the Hebrews prosperous under his reign, blessed above all with the greatest of goods: peace, freedom from war and from civil strife. "You, then," he said, "since you were declared king by God even before your birth, strive in every other way to be worthy of his providence, by being pious, just, and courageous, and guard the commandments and laws he gave us through Moses, and do not allow others to transgress them. As for the temple which he has chosen to have built during your reign, be eager to render it to God, and do not be daunted by the scale of the work nor lose heart before it, for I will have everything ready for you before my own death. Know that I have already gathered 10,000 talents of gold and 100,000 talents of silver, and I have amassed bronze and iron beyond counting, and an abundance of timber and stone as well, and you have at your disposal many thousands of stonecutters and craftsmen. If anything more is needed besides these, you will supply it. Be excellent, then, having God as your protector." He also urged the leaders of the people to help his son with the building, and, free from every trouble, to devote themselves to the worship of God, for in return they would reap peace and good order, the rewards with which God repays pious and just men. He further instructed that once the temple was built, the ark and the sacred vessels, which for a long time now had lacked a temple to house them, ever since our fathers, in obedience to God's commandment, had failed to build one, should be deposited there, after they had taken possession of this land and built him a temple. These were the things David said to the leaders and to his son. Now that he was already old and his body chilled with age, he was so susceptible to cold that even piling on many blankets could not warm him. When the physicians came together and gave their counsel, they proposed that a beautiful virgin, chosen from the whole country, should sleep beside the king, for the girl's warmth, they said, would be a remedy for his chill. A woman was found in the city more beautiful in appearance than any other, named Abishag, and by sleeping beside the king alone she warmed him, for through old age he was too weak for the pleasures of love and intercourse with a woman. We will speak of this virgin again shortly. David's fourth son, a handsome and tall young man, born to him by a wife named Haggith, was called Adonijah. Resembling Absalom, he too was carried away in his own mind with the thought that he should be king, and told his friends that the throne ought to pass to him. He procured many chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Seeing this, his father neither rebuked him nor restrained him from his purpose, nor did he even go so far as to ask why he was doing these things. Adonijah's collaborators were Joab the general and Abiathar the high priest. The only ones who opposed him were Zadok the high priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the commander of the bodyguard, Shimei, David's friend, and all the bravest men. When Adonijah prepared a feast outside the city, near the spring in the royal garden, and invited all his brothers except Solomon, taking with him also Joab the general and Abiathar, and the leaders of the tribe of Judah, but did not invite Zadok the high priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the commander of the bodyguard, or any of those of the opposing party to the banquet, Nathan the prophet reported this to Solomon's mother, Bathsheba, telling her that Adonijah intended to become king, and advised her to save both herself and her son Solomon, in case Adonijah should indeed seize the throne, and to go inquire of the king about this. While she was still speaking of this to the king, the prophet said he too would come in and would confirm her words. Persuaded by Nathan, Bathsheba went in to the king, and after bowing before him and asking leave to speak, she related to him everything just as the prophet had instructed her. The feast of Adonijah and those he had invited to it, Abiathar the high priest and Joab the commander and his own sons, leaving out Solomon and his closest friends. She said that the whole people were watching to see whom he would appoint king, and urged him to bear in mind that once he had passed away, if Adonijah became king, he would put both her and her son Solomon to death. While the woman was still speaking, the attendants of the chamber announced that Nathan wished to see him. When the king ordered him to be admitted, Nathan entered and asked whether he had that day proclaimed Adonijah king and handed over the kingdom to him. For Adonijah, he said, had prepared a splendid feast and invited all his sons except Solomon, along with Joab the general, who together with the others were feasting amid much noise and merriment and praying for his rule to last forever. "But he did not invite me," he said, "nor Zadok the high priest, nor Benaiah the commander of the bodyguard, and it would only be right that all should know whether this was done with your approval." When Nathan had said this, the king ordered Bathsheba to be called back in, for she had left the chamber when the prophet arrived. When the woman came in, he said to her, "I swear to you by the greatest God that your son Solomon shall be king, as I swore before, and that he shall sit upon my throne, and this shall happen today." After the woman bowed before him and prayed for him a long life, he summoned Zadok the high priest and Benaiah the commander of the bodyguard. And when they arrived, he ordered them to take with them Nathan the prophet and the guards stationed around the court, set his son Solomon on the royal mule, lead him outside the city to the spring called Gihon, and anoint him with the sacred oil and proclaim him king. He charged Zadok the high priest and Nathan the prophet to perform this, and ordered them, as they went, to proceed through the middle of the city sounding trumpets and proclaiming, "Long live King Solomon!" and to seat him upon the royal throne, so that all the people would know that he had been declared king by his father, and that Solomon had been charged concerning his rule to preside piously and justly over the whole nation of the Hebrews and over the tribe of Judah. After Benaiah had prayed that God would be gracious to Solomon, without the slightest delay they set Solomon on the mule, led him out of the city to the spring, anointed him with the oil, and brought him back into the city amid shouts of acclamation and prayers that his reign would be long. And bringing him to the royal palace, they seated him upon the throne, and all the people at once turned to feasting and celebration, dancing and delighting in the sound of flutes, so that the whole earth and sky seemed to resound with the multitude of instruments. When Adonijah and those present at the feast heard the shouting, they were thrown into confusion, and Joab the general said he did not like the sound of the trumpets. While the feast lay untouched before them and no one ate, and all of them were sunk in anxious thought, Jonathan, the son of Abiathar the high priest, came running into them. Adonijah, seeing the young man, greeted him warmly and called him a bearer of good news, and Jonathan told them everything about Solomon and about King David's decision. At this, Adonijah and all his guests leaped up from the banquet and fled, each to his own home. Adonijah, fearing the king because of what had happened, became a suppliant of God and took hold of the horns of the altar, which projected from it, and made this known to Solomon, asking to receive pledges from him that he would not bear a grudge or do him any harm. Solomon, with great mildness and self-control, forgave him his offense for the time, but told him that if he were found again attempting some new scheme, he would himself be responsible for his own punishment. Then he sent for him and raised him up from his supplication. When Adonijah came and bowed before him, Solomon told him to go to his own house, free of suspicion, and urged him to conduct himself well from now on, since this would be to his own advantage. Wishing to proclaim his son king before the whole people, David called together the officials to Jerusalem, along with the priests and the Levites. Counting them, he found first that those between 30 and 50 years of age numbered 38,000. Of these, he appointed 24,000 to oversee the building of the temple, 6,000 as judges of the people and scribes, 4,000 as gatekeepers, and an equal number as singers of hymns to God, using the instruments David himself had made, as we said before. He divided them by families, and separating out the priests from the tribe, found among them 24 families, 16 from the house of Eleazar, 8 from that of Ithamar, and appointed each family to serve God for 8 days, from one Sabbath to the next. And so all the families cast lots in the presence of David, and of Zadok and Abiathar the high priests, and of all the officials. And the family that came up first was recorded first, the second family followed in order, and so on to the 24th. This division has remained in force to this very day. He also organized the tribe of Levi into 24 divisions, and when they too had cast lots, they came up in the same manner to serve alongside the courses of the priests for 8 days each. He also honored the descendants of Moses, appointing them guardians of the treasures of God and of the votive offerings that the kings had dedicated. He ordered all those of the tribe of Levi and the priests to serve God by night and by day, just as Moses had instructed them. After this, he divided the army into 12 divisions, each with commanders, centurions, and officers of companies. Each division numbered 24,000 men, and he ordered them to attend on King Solomon in rotation for 30 days, from the first day to the last, together with their commanders of thousands and of hundreds. He also appointed over each division a leader whom he knew to be good and just, and other officials over the treasuries, the villages, the fields, and the herds, whose names I did not think it necessary to record. When he had arranged all these matters in the manner described, he called together the leaders of the Hebrews, the heads of the tribes, the commanders of the divisions, and all those placed in charge of any business or property of the king, to an assembly. And standing upon a very high platform, the king spoke to the people. "Brothers and countrymen, I want you to know that when I resolved to build a temple to God, I made ready a great quantity of gold and 100,000 talents of silver. But God, through the prophet Nathan, prevented me, because of the wars I fought for your sake, and because my right hand had been stained by the killing of my enemies, and instead commanded that my son, who was to succeed to the kingdom, should build the temple for him. Now then, just as our forefather Jacob had 12 sons, and you know that Judah was chosen as king among them, and I too, though I was one of 6 brothers, was preferred above them and received the kingship from God, and none of them resented it. So I ask that my own sons likewise not quarrel with one another now that Solomon has received the kingdom, but rather, understanding that it was God, chose him gladly to bear him as master. For it is no hardship to serve one whom God has willed to rule, even a brother of one's own. Rather, it is fitting to rejoice that a brother has attained this honor, as though sharing in it oneself. I pray that God's promises may come to full completion, and that this prosperity may be sown throughout the whole land and remain there for all time, as he himself promised to provide it under King Solomon. These things will stand firm and come to a fair end, if you show yourself pious and just and a guardian of our ancestral laws, my son. But if not, expect the worse for transgressing them." Having spoken these words, the king fell silent, and in front of everyone he handed over to Solomon the plan and design for building the temple. He specified the foundations, the chambers, and the upper rooms, how many there should be and how great in height and breadth, and he fixed the weight of all the gold and silver vessels. He also urged him, by his words, to apply himself to the work with every eagerness, and urged the officials and the tribe of Levi to join in the labor, both because of their age and because God himself had chosen him as leader both of the building of the temple and of the kingdom. He declared that the building would be easy for them and not very burdensome, since he himself had prepared many talents of gold, still more of silver, timber, a multitude of craftsmen and stonecutters, and already quarried emerald and every kind of costly stone. "And now," he said, "as a first fruit offering of his own service, he would give another 3,000 talents of pure gold for the inner sanctuary, and for the chariot of God, the cherubim which must stand covering the ark." When David fell silent, great eagerness arose among the officials, the priests, and the tribe of Levi, who contributed and made splendid and magnificent pledges. For gold they undertook to bring in 5,000 talents and 10,000 staters, and 10,000 talents of silver, and many tens of thousands of talents of iron. And whoever had a costly stone brought it and handed it over to the treasuries, which were administered by Iolos, the descendant of Moses. At this the whole people rejoiced, and David, seeing the zeal and generosity of the officials, the priests, and everyone else, began to bless God with a loud cry, calling him Father and origin of all things, and maker of things human and divine with which he had adorned himself, and protector and guardian of the race of the Hebrews and of their prosperity and of the kingdom he had given him. After this, he prayed for good things for the whole people, and for his son Solomon, a sound and just mind, strong in every part of virtue, and he bade the multitude bless God as well. They fell to the ground and worshipped, and gave thanks also to David for all the benefits they had enjoyed under his reign. On the following day, they offered sacrifices to God, 1,000 calves, as many rams, and 1,000 lambs, which they burned whole. They also offered the peace offerings, slaughtering many tens of thousands of victims. The king feasted with all the people through the whole day, and they anointed Solomon a second time with oil and proclaimed him king, and Zadok high priest of the whole multitude. Bringing Solomon to the palace and seating him on his father's throne, from that day they obeyed him. A short time later, David fell into sickness from old age, and knowing that he was about to die, he called his son Solomon and spoke to him as follows. I, my child, am now departing to what is fated, going the way common to my fathers and to all who now exist and all who will exist, from which no one returning can learn what happens in life. Therefore, while I am still alive and already close to death, I urge upon you what I have already counseled before, to be just toward your subjects, pious toward the God who gave you the kingdom, and to keep his commandments and the laws which he sent down to us through Moses, neither yielding to favor, flattery, desire, nor any other passion so as to neglect them. For you will lose God's goodwill toward yourself if you transgress any of the laws, and you will turn away his good providence from everything. But by showing yourself to be the kind of man you ought to be, and the kind I urge you to be, you will keep the kingdom for our family, and no other house of the Hebrews will ever rule, but we ourselves for all time. Remember also the lawless deed of Joab the general, who out of jealousy killed two just and good generals, Abner son of Ner and Amasa son of Jether. Avenge their deaths as you see fit, since Joab, being stronger and more powerful than I, has escaped justice until now. I also commend to you the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, whom you will keep in every honor and care, doing me this favor. For we are not the first to do good, but are repaying a debt for what their father did for me during my flight. And Shimei son of Gera, of the tribe of Benjamin, who cursed me abundantly during my flight, when I was going to Mahanaim, and met me at the Jordan and received pledges that he would suffer nothing at that time, now, finding a reasonable pretext, punish him. Having given his son this counsel about all his affairs and about his friends, and about those he knew deserved punishment, he died, having lived 70 years, and having reigned 7 years and 6 months over the tribe of Judah in Hebron, and 33 years over the whole country in Jerusalem. Such a man, the best of men and possessed of every virtue, and entrusted as king with the safety of so many nations, deserved praise both for the vigor of his power and for the wisdom of his self-control. For he was courageous as no other man, and in the struggles waged on behalf of his subjects, he was first to rush into danger, urging his soldiers to toil and fight in battle by his own example, not by commanding them as a master would. He was most capable of understanding and grasping both what was to come and how to manage present affairs. He was self-controlled, fair, kind to those in misfortune, just and humane, qualities most fitting for kings alone to have, and he erred in nothing whatever, given the greatness of his power, except in the matter of Uriah's wife. He left behind wealth greater than any other king, whether of the Hebrews or of other nations. His son Solomon buried him in Jerusalem magnificently, with all else that custom requires for a royal funeral, and indeed he buried with him a great and abundant quantity of wealth, the extent of which one may easily judge from what will now be told. For after a period of 1,300 years, Hyrcanus the high priest, when besieged by Antiochus, surnamed the Pious, son of Demetrius, wishing to give him money to lift the siege and lead the army away, and having no other means of raising it, opened one chamber of David's tomb, removed 3,000 talents, and gave part of it to Antiochus, and so ended the siege, as we have shown elsewhere. And after this, many years later, King Herod likewise opened another chamber and took out a great deal of money. Neither of them, however, reached the burial vaults of the kings themselves, for these had been hidden underground by artifice, so that they would not be visible to those entering the tomb. But on this subject, let what we have said suffice.